This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What is the role of scientists in public policy decisions? Albert Einstein, who wrote a letter to President Roosevelt warning him about Nazi Germany developing the atomic bomb, also wrote, "Those with the privilege to know have the duty to act." Fast forward to this year, where scientists have been quite involved with political decision-making. Sitting next to Secretary of State John Kerry, as he hashed out a nuclear deal with Iran, was Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, a nuclear physicist. The terms of the deal were spelled out during a face-to-face meeting by two scientists, Moniz and his Iranian counterpart, Ali Akbar Salehi. And just this week, a group of 29 scientists, including one of my next guests, signed a letter backing the proposal, calling it innovative and stringent. So what role can scientists play in determining global policy? Should they? How can science make inroads where other negotiations fall short? Let me introduce my guest. Rush Holt is the former congressional representative for New Jersey's 12th District and a former plasma physicist. He's now the CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and executive publisher of the Science Journal Group, which puts out a science magazine. Welcome to Science Friday. Good to talk to you again.
Well, thanks, Ira. I always look forward to being with you.
Thank you. Vaughn Derikian is the science and technology officer to the Secretary of State. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much, Ira. I look forward to this.
Rush, why did you feel it was important to send that letter backing the deal? How does a scientist view this plan differently compared to a politician?
Well, after the agreement was announced and the 100-and-some pages were available, some former Foreign Service officers and ambassadors wrote a letter saying that from their point of view, they thought this really made sense internationally. And then a group of flag officers, admirals and generals, wrote a letter saying from their point of view, militarily, it made sense. And so some of us with a background in the science and technology of nuclear proliferation and nuclear weapons and so forth looked at it and came to the conclusion that from our point of view, as with regard to verification and detection of diversion and the things that nonproliferation specialists are concerned about, this made sense. It hangs together. And as we said in the letter, there are a number of innovations, and it's a really quite a strong, for this kind of thing, the strongest agreement. And so we thought we ought to put that down in writing for the president and release that to the public.
You know, I quoted Albert Einstein about those with the privilege to know have the duty to act. That was certainly along the lines of scientists who have the privilege to know about these things and acting on that privilege.
It is a privilege to be a scientist. It's an exciting path of discovery, but there are some obligations that come with it. Obligations for the practice of the science to make sure that we follow good ethical and rules of open communication and fairness in the application of our science and so forth. And then there are also obligations to make sure that the science is used for the public good. And that means communicating with the public about the science, and in this case, the technology that's related to nuclear weapons.
Vaughn, as science and technology advisor to the Secretary of State, does science have a place in diplomacy, or does the Secretary of State just listen and sort of take it in that way?
You know, Ira, thank you for that question. I think that what we're seeing more and more in the world today is that the challenges that the world faces are now seeing more and more science, technology, health, engineering issues coming into them. I mean, you mentioned one of them. There are a number of others, from health issues that we saw in Africa with Ebola and its spread. We see it with issues around environment and energy and figuring out how to make both abundant amounts of energy but also in a clean way. And these are foreign policy challenges, but they are also inherently science, technology, engineering, and health challenges. And you see more of this. And it's the reason really why over the last 15 years, there has been a real effort to increase the numbers of scientists and science coming into the Department of State. I am just on the job for the last 4 days, and I've been had the privilege of being preceded by four outstanding scientists who served in the same role that I'm in right now.
Mm-hmm. I know there's a. I know that now that we're opening diplomatic relations with Cuba, Cuba has some of the most pristine marine ecology systems in the world. Is science going to be working? American scientists working down there to learn about that too?
I'll just mention briefly that I had the opportunity when I was not in government very early on, even when the relationships were not where they are now, to be part of some groups that went down and talked about science, broadly speaking, not, as you mentioned, Ira, the marine issues are really ripe for a lot of cooperation, and there have been in the non-governmental realm. But even now going forward, there's a lot of the issues that will sort of underpin the relationship around things like atmospheric sciences and health and other things as well. We'll have almost by definition, science and health and technology and environment as key elements.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones and take a phone call. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And Ira, this Rush. Is Rush. I do want to get in a little plug for the AAAS, where I'm now very pleased to work, and to say with some pride that Von Tarikian, until this week, was our international officer. And there he worked with the Cubans on scientific exchanges. AAAS has a long history of bringing science to international relations with respect to Iran, Burma, or Myanmar. And right now we're doing international seismology in a volcano in North Korea. So Vaughn, in his previous life and now as the science advisor to the Secretary of State, I think has done a lot and will do a lot to foster international scientific cooperation.
Let me go to the phones. Adrian in Phoenix, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, how's it going?
Hi, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, so I just have a quick comment about scientists and politics in general is that I notice these days is that a lot of policymakers don't necessarily understand what's going on in the world as far as science and what the latest technologies have to do or say about these things, but they also don't want to learn. And since scientists are essentially trying to learn everything all the time, I think that they have an obligation in politics to teach rather than make decisions. And I think that having a better educated populace to make decisions in a democracy will lead to better decisions in general with things like climate change and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Good question. What about the duty of scientists to teach when we're in a political climate and scientists is very much involved, Rush?
Well, that's what I meant when I used the word communication earlier, because I mean communication in the truest sense of really communicating ideas and teaching. And I think the caller was saying that the scientist should not presume to submit to claim to have better value judgments, to have a better sense of democratic values than ordinary citizens, non-scientist citizens, I mean. But we can teach the principles as well as the excitement and the beauty of the science, and we can help them understand the key points that go into it, into the political and social and value judgments.
Well, how do you answer someone who, you know, when you talk about global warming or climate change, how do you answer someone who's not afraid to say, you know, I can't make a judgment on this. I'm not a scientist.
Well, we have to get the American public away from that point of view, whether it's climate change or vaccination or questions of communication or teaching biology in high schools. There are things that ordinary folks can understand if the scientists are careful not to try to snow them with terminology and detailed methodology, but really to try to communicate the essence of science, of the practice of science, which is a way of refining our thinking to get to progressively better and better understanding of the world. It's a self-correcting system, and it's a process, what Lewis Thomas called the shrewdest maneuver. I love that phrase, shrewdest maneuver for understanding how the world works. It's something that anybody can do up to a point, and everyone should do, and scientists should help them do it and not hide this this beautiful and powerful methodology behind methodological details and terms that are meant to obscure rather than elucidate.
But we're living in a time where Congress, the budget, especially for the National Science Foundation, is controlled by Congress and a conservative political agenda on the committees that fund NSF. Are scientists fearful of saying something might offend that committee that is funding their very research?
Well, the point is not to say that in a confrontational way, but to show where the evidence leads. You know, I often say to students, as you go forward professionally, and if you want to be on the winning side, follow the evidence, because ultimately the evidence trumps ideology. Certainly an awful lot that goes on Capitol Hill right now, and I'm, you know, only 6 months or 9 months now out of Capitol Hill, out of Congress. Certainly an awful lot that goes on there is ideology, and often in an evidence-free way. And so it's a challenge for scientists to point out the power of following the evidence, of evaluating the evidence, teaching people that ordinary folks can evaluate evidence too. You don't have to just throw up your hands and say, well, I can't understand that. Let's leave that to the scientists.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
And Ira, this is Vaughn. I would just add to this, because I think Rush absolutely knows that world better than anybody as a scientist and as a congressman and somebody who's had to interface with that world, that one of the interesting things for me is always that we as scientists not only have to do a better job of communicating to the public, but also reaching out and engaging to those in universities and other places who maybe aren't going to go on and get their PhD in science. I had the privilege of being the offspring of a scientist who is a professor at Yale for 57 years. And when I was talking to my father, he would often say the hardest classes sometimes for him to teach were the introductory classes, because half the class might not be interested in it, or they might be taking it for different reasons. But in many ways, over time, he realized that he was a professor at Yale, that in many ways he could have access and teach them for just a little while about, as Rush mentioned, the beauty and the elegance of science, and that maybe that would captivate them in the world in which they were going into, even if it weren't going to be in a scientific discipline, and maybe stick with them. So that's it's another group that we have to cultivate.
But do you think that scientists should be proactive in speaking out when they hear something that just is off the wall, you know, about being said publicly about science?
Well, you know, this is Rush again. Of course they should. But if the other person or group is wedded to their ideology, then approaching them confrontationally will only drive them deeper into their ideology. And so the talented teachers, the creative teachers and scientists, if they're good, can help people understand that it's the evidence that counts.
Can you give me an example?
Not your preconception.
Yeah. Give me an example of where that would work.
Sure. I mean, right now, the probably most ideological debate is about climate change. Before any discussion starts, people have already drawn up sides.
Right.
And they try to say, well, We have more scientists on our side than you do, you know, whether whichever side that is, as if this is a vote by scientists. No, it's about how scientists evaluate the evidence and how you, as a informed and concerned citizen who should care about, you know, whether your kids are going to be able to have decent living standards, how you can evaluate that evidence rather than just assert again and again which side you're on.
Mm-hmm. So you leave it up to people to just look at the evidence themselves and make their own minds up.
Well, it doesn't work for scientists to try to substitute their understanding for the public understanding. First of all, it's not wise. The public, you know, I had a rule of thumb often, which was never overestimate the knowledge of the public and never underestimate their wisdom. The scientists shouldn't substitute their understanding for the public, but they should help the public understand what the evidence says.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run out of time.
Evidence-based thinking, you know, is the goal here, I would argue, and it's hard to come by.
It's critical thinking. Rush Holt, thank you, as always, for taking time to be with us. Now that you're free of those reins of government, we hope to have you back on a little more often.
Thanks. I'm really delighted to be at AAAS. It's a great organization with important work to do and important mm-hmm. work underway.
And Vaughn Tarikian, thank you for taking time to be with us, and maybe we'll get some more insight into you as you've now become part of the government and learning as Rush did what it's like to be inside. So we'd like to hear from you a little bit later. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.